Typically, a single family home is assigned one number in the numbering sequence of that street. So in our home in Markham, we live at number 49, and so naturally to one side is number 47, and to the other side is number 51. We couldn't choose any other number, even if we wanted to. Larger buildings occupy more space and can choose which number to use. And so to the east of this building is number 88, and to the west is number 64. So I presume that when this building was placed here, the church could have chosen any even number from 66 to 86 as the number for the church. Well, one of the churches that I served, Temple Baptist in Windsor, was located at 664 Victoria Avenue. And one of our members who had been in advertising was always looking for something that was a little catchy or would attract some attention. And he wondered out loud to me one day why we didn't use one of the unused numbers that belonged to the space we occupied. Why not list our address, he said, as 666 Victoria Avenue? I thought he was kidding for a minute, but he wasn't. I said, I thought it likely that we didn't want to do anything that would suggest a new nickname for the church. Number of the Beast Baptist Church. 666. Understanding chapter 13 of Revelation begins with looking back at chapter 12. We're told in verse 7, that war broke out in heaven. Years ago, I was at a conference where one of the speakers was the Reverend Dr. Gardner Taylor, whom you can still see. I think Dr. Taylor is still alive, but he's in his 90s. He's not preaching anymore. But you can still find him on YouTube, and he is worth looking up. One of the great Baptist preachers of his generation. Dr. Taylor used this particular verse, chapter 12 of Revelation, verse 7. He used this verse as a proof text for his statement that Baptists, no matter what is said about us by all sorts of people and all sorts of other Christians, the Baptists are the only denomination with biblical proof that we have a place in heaven. For he said, if war broke out in heaven of all places, that is surely proof that the Baptists are there. Well, I take you back to that verse because the dragon, identified as Satan, is defeated in this war and thrown out of heaven. In chapter 13, which we're looking at today, they continue the war, but this time the war is on earth. Now let me say from the start, as I suppose I could say about any part of this book that is so rich in imagery and in symbolism, that my opinion, that the interpretation that you're going to hear from me this morning is only one that you can find in regard to this chapter. For example, it probably doesn't take much imagination to realize that during the time of the Protestant Reformation, there were particular people who identified Martin Luther as the beast of Revelation. The Roman Catholics, of course, identified Luther as the beast. And it probably doesn't take much imagination to go the next step and realize that, of course, the Protestant Reformers identified the Pope as the beast. So all through history and today, there are various interpretations of who the beast is. So my interpretation is just one of those. But let's look at what John says to us. At the end of chapter 12, he tells us that the dragon took his stand on the sand of the seashore. Now there's no need to do any guessing or speculating as to who the dragon is. According to chapter 12, verse 9, the dragon is the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. Now, this beast stands on the shore of the sea, we are told. Now, on the screen, you'll see this map of, and I'm, to be honest with you, I don't really know what exactly was the known world in Palestine of the first century. But I do know this. I think most people in that time, most people assumed that this was the edge of the world. That Spain was the western edge of the world. I don't know how far they certainly knew that the world went east for quite a bit, but I think they assumed that Spain was the edge of the world. And so there is a seashore there. But there is also a seashore right here. And almost on the shore, I think Adolfo could help me with this but I think it's within about 40 to 60 kilometers of the seashore is the city of Rome. And of course, Rome was the headquarters of the emperor. So I think that when people heard about a beast that came out of the sea, they would think of Rome and the emperor. One of the things that I have discovered in my study for this series is that there are times when John is very specific and times when he's vague. No need to guess, as I said, about who the dragon is. The dragon is Satan. But who is the beast that comes out of the sea? Well, verse 3 of chapter 13. It says, one of its heads, this is the beast, one of its heads seemed to have received a death blow, but its mortal wound had been healed. Now, one of the great enemies of the church in the first century was that scoundrel and supposed amateur fiddle player named Nero. In the final days of Nero's reign, open revolts had broken out in both Gaul, modern-day France, and Spain. And then Nero lost the support of the Roman Senate. After taking refuge at a friend's villa outside the city, he heard that the Senate had declared him to be a public enemy and that soldiers were approaching his hiding place. He took matters into his own hands, cutting his own throat with a sword. Now, lest you think that conspiracy theories are anything new, soon after Nero's death, rumors began to spread that in fact he hadn't died. In the latter part of the 20th century and he were from Memphis, Tennessee, people would say, well, no, he didn't die. He's been seen in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And you know, I'm talking about Elvis. And so rumors began to spread very soon after Nero's death that he hadn't died, but that he had fled to the eastern edge of the empire where he was much more popular than he was in the west and in around Rome. And the rumors were that not only had he gone there, but that he was there and amassing a huge army that would come back and put him again on the throne. There were others who said, oh no, he had died. But what was coming was that Nero was going to rise from the dead and again take the throne. So it's possible then that the beast with a mortal wound that is healed is thought to be none other than Nero. Except Nero's reign ended in AD 68, and John is writing more than 20 years later. And John tells us that the vision given to him is of what must soon take place, not what has already taken place. So is the beast Nero? Well, friends, I really think the answer is yes and no, and I'll explain that before we finish. For now, let's go to the beginning of our text read this morning and the appearance of another beast that rose out of the earth. One of the things that I don't know why, we're told that the land beast is subservient to the sea beast, and I don't know why that is. That's just what we're told. But there are all sorts of things to notice about this particular beast. First of all, the addition of a second beast kind of completes what I've called the satanic trinity. There's three of them. The first beast gets its authority from the dragon, which is Satan. And the second beast exercises its authority on behalf of the first beast. It's, you know, kind of like the musketeers, all for one and one for all among these malevolent creatures. Notice also in verse 11 of our text that it says that this beast had two horns like a lamb. And in Revelation, to speak of a lamb is to call to mind from chapter 5 the lamb who was slaughtered, but who is found, who is alive, and who is found to be worthy to open the scrolls, Jesus. To speak of a lamb is to call Jesus to mind. So the intent of the second beast is to deceive not only the ordinary citizens of Asia, but to deceive as many Christians as possible. Because this second beast might remind them of Jesus. Now the second beast calls on everyone to worship the first beast. And here is part of the answer to our question about whether or not this first beast is the Emperor Nero. My conclusion is the best answer to this question is that the first beast is any emperor, including Nero. Any emperor who demands for himself the worship that should be given only to our God and Creator and our Lord Jesus Christ. The second beast, doing the bidding of the first, is then everyone who encourages and fosters emperor worship. And one of the things that historians tell us is that in the provinces, and particularly in the province of Asia, where John lived, where the people in his churches lived, that in the province of Asia, there was an elaborate system that supported this cult of worshiping the emperor. There were priests, there were sacrifices, there were temples, there were statues, there were festivals. Now, I mentioned conspiracy theories. And I suppose also a general mistrust of what we are told to believe. And we might wonder about these folks back then believing things like Nero coming back to life. And yet, a poll taken a year ago shows that 28% of Americans believe a secretive power elite with a globalist agenda is conspiring to eventually rule the world through an authoritarian world government, the New World Order, as it's called, NWO. 29% believe aliens exist. 51% believe a larger conspiracy was at work in the JFK assassination, and frankly, I'd count myself in that 51%. 15% say the government or the media adds mind-controlling technology to TV broadcast signals. Now that's the so-called tinfoil hat crowd. You've seen pictures of them. Therefore, it would not be the hardest thing in the world to foster a sense of reverence regarding the current emperor by telling stories about a former emperor who was going to come back to life. In addition, there were tricks, what we might call sideshow acts. I have a description that comes from a 2nd century AD writer named Lucian, but it helps to explain what is said in verse 15 of our text. I don't know whether any of you noticed it, but let me say it again, or let me point it out again in verse 15. It said it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast could even speak and cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Well, this writer, Lucian, he writes about a self-styled prophet by the name of Alexander. And Alexander, in the great tradition of Barnum and Bailey, Alexander he devises a statue. And this is the, by the way, this is a picture that I found on the internet, of course, a picture of the Roman god Asclepius. Asclepius is the Roman god of healing. And the symbol of Asclepius, which I hope you can see it, the symbol of Asclepius, which is wound around this pole, is a snake. And you see that, you see it today. The snake wound around a pole is still a symbol of medicine. And so, anyway, what Alexander did, it's hard not to admire his ingenuity. Because what he did is that he put together a statue or an image, and I don't know whether there was whether it was like this, whether there was an image of Asclepius and the snake beside it, or whether it was just the image of the snake. But he got canvas, and he put together a canvas snake. And Lucian describes how this worked, and basically what this prophet Alexander did was that he made a puppet out of this snake. And with horsehairs, he had horsehairs attached to the mouth and to the tongue of the snake so that the mouth opened up and the tongue went back and forth. And then he got a really good idea and he thought, now how can I get this beast to speak, just like our verse says. And he thought, well, I know what I can do. And he went and got, I don't know whether he actually killed the birds or got a number of dead cranes, the bird, the crane, and he got their windpipes. Now, I don't know how, you know, cranes have long necks. I don't know how many windpipes he needed. But he sewed together as many windpipes of cranes as he needed, which of course are hollow. And he fitted those, you know, wound those through the body of the snake. And then Alexander's able assistant was out, you know, out behind the statue, unseen, and he spoke through his end of the tube, making it appear that the snake of Asclepius was speaking. And so worshippers would come, and the snake would speak to them, presumably telling them to give generous offerings to Alexander. So we read something as we did in chapter 13 about a beast speaking, and we say, well, I wonder what that's about. Well, probably it's about this sideshow act, this kind of trickery, this kind of fakery, which would make people think that the God was speaking to them. One last detail to notice about this second beast. It says, those who worship the beast are given a mark on their right hand or forehead, and only those with the mark can buy and sell in the marketplace. Now, I want you to know, friends, the important thing here is not the mark. And in case you're wondering, I do not think that this is a prophecy predicting the UPC or Universal Product Code that appears on everything that we buy and which the cashiers from everywhere from Holt Renfrew to the local convenience store scan when they sell us a product. I don't think the mark is the UPC. But there are some who disagree with me, so I'll be fair. I think the important thing to recognize here is that John is saying being faithful to Christ sometimes has economic consequences. When I thought of this, I reminded me of a course that I took back at Laurier in Canadian history, and the prof who taught the course loved to tell stories of what he called the bad old days of Canadian politics, and talked about the fact that there were roads in Canada in the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, roads which went from one constituency into another, a highway from one constituency into another. And there would be roads that would be paved in one constituency and unpaved in the other, because the people in that second constituency had the nerve to send a grit to Ottawa, and you know, it was the Tories that were in power, and so they punished, you know, and vice versa, of course. You know, economic consequences for your decisions. And what John is saying here is that for Christians, there are sometimes economic consequences to being faithful to Christ. And so we need to understand, friends, that when an emperor, when a president, when a prime minister, when any leader attempts to claim such loyalty, that they are in fact asking for your worship, then you need to know. You need to know that that person, such a person, will do anything to weaken your commitment to the true God and Father of us all. There may be economic consequences to making a stand for Christ. Well, now we come to what is perhaps the best known bit of the Revelation. It says, "This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a person." Its number is 666. And among the various suggestions that have been made, said one scholar, the most likely explanation for 666 is that it is a riddle. It is an example of the practice of what's called gematria, a numerical riddle in which the words or names are coded as numbers. And this is made possible because in Greek, certain letters are given a numerical value. If this 666 is referring to a particular person, the best guess is again the Emperor Nero. But I would go back to my earlier comment about this book being a vision of what must soon take place, not what has already taken place. So let me try out another idea with you. According to what the Scripture says, it is going to take wisdom and understanding to identify the identity or to discern the identity of this person. And I think John has given us a clue not simply to the identity of one person, but to a characteristic of this beast that has been given the authority of Satan. For in the ancient world, numbers were thought to have particular significance. For example, 7 is thought to be a perfect number. 6, then, is less than perfect. 3 times less than perfect. If there is such a word, triply imperfect. I don't think there is, but you know what I mean. So I think the message here, despite the description of beasts and other horrors, I think the message is actually straightforward. Until the return of Christ, until the new heaven and new earth is brought about by God, it is as if spiritual war is raging on earth. Satan will do whatever he can to turn Christians away from their allegiance to God and to God's Christ. So, Christian, examine your life. Examine your priorities. Examine who or what it is that claims your worship. If you settle for anything less than God, if you are bowing before any 666. What you worship is not worth it. For it is only God who is perfect, only God who is worthy of our worship. Let me give you one more image. When all is said and done, you need to remember this. Somewhere around the year 60, 62, I think it was, the Apostle Paul stood in chains as a prisoner before Nero. And I'm sure that Nero thought, this will be the end of this Christian nonsense. But 20 centuries later, mothers and fathers name their sons after Paul. And if they use the name Nero at all, they name their dogs after him. Amen.